So today we're going to be in Exodus chapter 23. Oh, before I get started, I imagine you all saw it, but I left you a colored two-sided map out there that we may get to today. So pick one of those up if you didn't. But today we're still in chapter 23. Last time we looked at the first part of the chapter, in verses 1 through 9, we saw laws that God gave them, directions for how to live, about citizenship and social life, and some things that we would say were pretty basic, but might have been radical in their day with some of the people that they lived around and the cultures they experienced. It started with don't tell lies, be truthful. Don't conspire with the wicked. Don't follow the crowd in becoming in a lack of justice toward injustice. Don't show partiality in judgment. Don't favor the poor. Don't favor the rich. Let the judgment come down based on the facts of the situation. Don't kill the innocent or the righteous. And then help those around you, including your enemies. If you see their animals out wandering around, take them back to them. If you see one of their animals needing rescue, help its owner rescue it. Don't oppress strangers. And he says to them, because you know what it's like. You've experienced slavery in Egypt. So don't treat others that same way. And then in verses 10 through 13 last year, we saw that the ground was to have a Sabbath. The land, the nation, when they got there, that 1 year out of seven was to be a Sabbath for the land. Don't plant. Now, if we went and studied their planting laws, we would find out that when they harvested, there were sections that they would kind of round out in their harvest and not get the whole corner, which I didn't think about at the time, but today if that hits me, because I've watched some guys in their harvest right now, and the saying used to be when I was a kid, yeah, he does a good job farming the ditches. Some farmers, well, if the plant can grow there and you can harvest it, that's more in your profit side, but there were provisions for the people who were poor and didn't have their own crops. And so this 1 year out of seven, don't plant, don't harvest, and so that the poor and the animals, the wild beasts, can feast on what you have left there, because there's going to be volunteer crops and all of those kinds of things. And it also lets your animals rest, lets you recharge your batteries as well. And God promised, not here in Exodus, but we did go look at God's promise when he's talking about it elsewhere as he's setting this up, that on the sixth year they would get a crop equivalent of 3 years. Of course, that was dependent upon doing what God asked them to do, which we also looked at the passage in Jeremiah where, why were they in exile 70 years? Because apparently for about 490 years they failed to do the Sabbath of the land. And so he said, fine, it's my land for the next 490 years, or next 70 years. And so they were in exile for 70 years while the land got its Sabbath. Also, God has reestablished, stated again, the weekly Sabbath. Are we that noisy for them? I don't know. Established the weekly Sabbath where they were going to, no, it's all closed up. But for 6 days you do your labor, and then on the seventh day you have your Sabbath. You and the people in your household, they all get to rest that seventh day, as well as your animals don't have to go out and work that seventh day. And finally, God made it real clear, don't even mention the name of other gods, so-called gods. And he made it very clear that was not to be a part of their culture. And of course, we know that they were headed into an area that was overrun by other gods that were worshipped and relied upon. And so God is saying, we're not even going to mention their names, let alone worship them. John MacArthur had a note, we talked about it last time, he's probably right on target, that this probably would help in the prohibition against intermarrying with these other tribes and these other nations, because in the marriage ceremony, If they worship another god, they're going to want their god named in the ceremony, and that might very well make it difficult or impossible to have those kinds of marriage ceremonies take place. And so that's what we covered in the first 13 verses last week. I want to start this week by reading verses 14 through 19. And so I'll read those and we'll talk about them. 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. Also you shall observe the feast of the harvest of the first fruits for your labors from what you sow in the field. Also the feast of the ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather the fruit of your labors from the field. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor is the fat of my feast to remain overnight until morning. You shall bring the choice first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. You are not to boil a young goat in the milk of its mother. And so in this passage, we get some direction about feasts and worship. And God, first of all, says there's going to be 3 main feasts. We're going to do them every year. And God says, they're feasts to me. It's easy in a feast to almost have a feast to yourself, isn't it? Isn't this fun? I'm having a lot of fun. It's a great gathering, a lovely fellowship. And people can have feasts that maybe even have religious overtones, but don't really have in it a feast that is intended to be directly a worshiping of God. Think of our own Thanksgiving feasts. I mean, around the United States, is Thanksgiving a big deal? Sure, everybody gets holidays and so on. But I would be confident in saying the majority of the families that have those feasts, it's not a feast of thanksgiving toward God. They're not even worshiping God. They don't even trust in God. And so, you know, you can have these feasts another way, but God says, these are feasts to me. It's a time to worship. Come be a part of worshiping. And he said, here are the contexts or the feasts, the 3 that I'm going to establish. And the first one he mentioned in verse 15, he's already established and announced it, but he announces it again, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. He announced it as they left Egypt. When they left Egypt, they were to take no leavening with them, right? And so they would go for this full 7 days without leavening as they left. But it's to become an annual feast. And there's not going to be any leavening in their food. There's not going to be leavening in their house. And over time, it will even become a national thing. They don't want any leavening in all of the...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
There's a handle in here. We can close the...
It's not closed?
No.
Yeah, I thought I found it, but I didn't.
Here it is.
Here, you can take it.
Thank you.
You bet. No problem. So this leavening, and of course we know that throughout the scriptures, leavening is a word picture, if you will, for sin, how it permeates everything. And so the first one here is this Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so that is planned. It follows the Passover feast. In the scriptures it says, as the appointed time in the month of Abib. And if you remember when we were looking at the original Passover, that Passover occurred on the 15th, and that was going to be the 15th of the month going forward annually, and it was at the conclusion of the Passover meal. From then on, they were into this time of no leavening in their diet, and it would become known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And it's to celebrate their coming out of Egypt and that they did not come out empty-handed. In what way were they not empty-handed? Yeah. The Egyptians were pleased to heap upon them the wealth. And so that's certainly a big piece of it. God isn't clear what he means here, but when we look back at the scriptures, God said, I'm going to give you favor in their sight. Now, it doesn't mean that they were going to be looking, that the Egyptians were going to be looking at the Israelites as their best friends. It meant that they would be getting favor, getting direction that would benefit them. They would benefit from their relationship. And the benefit is the Egyptians are saying, go or we're going to die. You have to go. If you don't go, we're not going to survive. And so they're heaping upon them their wealth in order to leave. So they left plundering what was then the richest nation on earth without much doubt. And so that's the first feast. And of course, we could look at many other ways that they also did not leave empty-handed. They left being led by God himself in a very successful way across the land over toward what we have come to show in this class we believe to be the Gulf of Aqaba, where they did the great crossing of the sea. And so they had many other things going for them as well, but certainly this wealth was a big deal. And so then in verse 16, he comes to the second feast, which is the harvest of first fruits. It is a time to celebrate your labors from what you sow in the field. Let's go over to Let's go over to Leviticus. Matthew was Levi, but whoa, I don't know how I got that connection. Let's go over to Leviticus chapter 23, and we want to read verses 9 through 14. And this has to do with this same concept, Feast of First Fruits, and it gives a little more detail that we ought to pay attention to. So Leviticus chapter 23, beginning with verse 9. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land which I am going to give you and reap its harvest, you shall bring in the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord for you to be accepted. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. Now on the day when you wave the sheaf, you shall offer a male lamb, 1 year old, without defect, for a burnt offering to the Lord. Its grain offering shall then be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering by fire to the Lord for a soothing aroma, with its drink offering, 1/4 of a hin of wine. Until this same day you shall have brought in the offering of your God. You shall not eat neither of the bread nor the roasted grain nor the new growth. It is to be a perpetual statute throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. And so this gives us a little more context for this celebration that goes with the first fruits. And here's the offering that goes with that celebration. And when we see that he says you're going to bring this in on the first day of the week following the Sabbath, if we were to back up and look at the context, this is the Sabbath. This is the Sabbath found in the celebration of the first fruit, celebration of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So you're going to bring this in on a what we would call a Sunday, because the Saturday would be the Sabbath day, in this time of unleavened bread, and you're to bring this in. And the priest then is going to take that offering in the form of a sheaf of grain, would be a piece of it, the starting point, and he's to wave it before God. This is an acknowledgement that God is the one providing. And so we have this wave offering, and then it goes on with the other offerings of a male lamb, and then the grain offering and the drink offering. And it's interesting. Now go over to 1 Corinthians 15:20. 1 Corinthians 15:20. Yeah, a little further. Almost there. 1 Corinthians 15:20. Am I in 15? Yes. Here's the verse. But now Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who are asleep. that first fruits takes on a little extra meaning when you realize the day he was raised is the day that aligns with the first Sabbath in the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the first day after the Sabbath in the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So Christ fits right in with this first fruits offering and the timing of his own resurrection. Now, in this time of celebrating the harvest, in Leviticus we read, oh, you bring this in, and you can't consume from the harvest, so here you are, you're having this initial harvest, which, by the way, like us, remind you what we talked about last time, they have two harvest periods. They planted a grain like wheat in the fall that they would harvest in the spring, and then they would plant others in the spring that they would harvest later at the end of the summer. And so this is that first offering, first harvest, and here they are with this new food coming in. They have been surviving off of the food from the last harvest or previous harvest, what they had stored in one fashion or another. And, you know, it would be very desirous to, let's get to the fresh fruit. I'm not a gardener. Never have been. It never fit my family's timing in their living. My mom taught school. A lot of the gardening things needed to be done when school was at its zenith in terms of her time. And my dad loved the garden, but he didn't have time because, you know, he was in the construction business most of the time. And when you needed to be planting, when we were getting out of the thaw and getting ready things to go and the summer was picking up, and we just never had time in our family for it. In later years, my parents did gardening. And even right now, there's somebody gardening in their garden spot, but it's not them. And he was in offering us some fresh watermelon. But for the people that really like things like tomatoes, which isn't on my list, but nonetheless, those first tomatoes, aren't they wonderful if you like them? And so people, you know, that fresh stuff out of the garden, those first things coming in are a big deal. And there are some things I do like fresh out of the garden, no doubt about it, but that's not one of them. But that's a big deal. But no. Until you have given God thanks for it through the feast of the first fruits, the harvest of first fruits, you're not allowed to consume. So you've got to hold back and wait until God has received his thanks for it. Now, you notice in Leviticus it said, when you get into the land, this is what you're going to do. So this feast is one that really won't be able to fully be celebrated until they're fully in the land, because they're going to live as nomads until they move into the land and begin to develop more of an agrarian lifestyle there, as God gives them this great fertile land for their inhabitation. Question, comments so far? Okay, another feast that God establishes here, the third one, is the Feast of the Ingathering. This is at the end of the year. That's when they gather the big bulk of their fruits for their labor. And it's celebrated, depending upon the way the calendar works out, either somewhere in late September, early October. It corresponded with what would be known as the Feast of the Booths or Tabernacles later. And so this is their big ingathering feast, when they again will thank God for his provision for them. One thing that happens in between, this is just kind of an extra for you. It's not in this passage, but it's interesting to me when I was reading, so I'll bring it to you. There's another one, the Feast of the Weeks. Feast of Weeks. It is also a grain offering, and it is completed 7 Sabbaths after the Feast of the First Fruits. I said 7 Sabbaths, yes. 50 days. Pentecost. Pentecost gets lined up. Its starting point is the Feast of the Ingathering of First Fruits. And we know how Pentecost figures into our rich history as believers. So though that last one was not one of the three, but Those are the three feasts that God establishes. Then in verse 17, then, he ties it together with this. Three times a year, all the males will appear before the Lord. So this isn't like we do Thanksgiving. When we do Thanksgiving, it's kind of our family, whatever that means to you. It might be your immediate family. It might be you and a bunch of brothers and sisters and their immediate families. It might be almost a family reunion where anybody that thinks they should belong to your family shows up. Could be lots of things, but in this case, they're to gather as a group before the Lord. So they're all trekking to a place together, would be aligned with the tabernacle and later the temple. And so they make this pilgrimage to the tabernacle. And if you think for a moment about what that's going to mean, is that all the men, and maybe their families will go with them in many cases, but at least the men make the pilgrimage for the gathering together for these three feasts. What did that do for the security of the nation? It left the whole nation wide open for someone who, or some group of people who would like to wreak havoc and become an enemy, militarily even, against them. And so there's a piece to this that also involves some faith in God's protection to accomplish the feasts. Does that make sense? If they're all going to follow God's direction, they're going to have to trust God that he's going to keep things safe in their absence. And then in verse 18, God talks about sacrifices a bit. And he says, the blood for my sacrifice, you're not to partake of that. That's not to be combined with the leavened, with leavened bread. In other words, the sanctification that goes along with the time of unleavened bread and all that it means to push this out of your world, symbolic, I think, of sin and impurity, as well as intentionality, as well as a certain level of haste and urgency. Don't diminish looking at my blood in the offering, the blood that's being offered to me. Don't diminish that by somehow mixing that with leavened bread. And he also says the fat of the sacrifice in verse 18, nor is the fat of my feast or my sacrifice remain overnight until morning. In other words, this isn't a nonchalant situation. This isn't a be a little bit lazy, take your time, we'll get it later kind of an attitude. This feast is to have some, and the sacrifices are to have some urgency to them, as well as some intentionality to be complete, to be thorough, to be whole, to not back off of anything you're doing here that would be a part of that worship. So complete the sacrifice. Don't be haphazard about how you do that. And just like in the Passover where they couldn't use leaven in the Passover meal and the lamb was to be eaten with nothing left. Okay, consume it all. Get it all done. Get the whole sacrifice made before you move on. And then in verse 19, he says, you shall not bring the choice fruits of your soil into the house. You shall bring the choice fruits of your soil into the household of the Lord your God. And so when you're doing the first fruits, you're going to take the first part of that harvest and it's going to become God's, right? Well, don't go out and harvest the scrubby stuff. This isn't an opportunity to differentiate your crops so that what you have to give up in a sacrifice or what you choose to give up in a sacrifice is the scrubby stuff. Bring the choicest to God. So when you do your harvest so that you can prepare for the feast of the first fruits and the sacrifice that goes along with it, get the best stuff. The best stuff comes out of the field first It's the best stuff. It's the choice stuff that God is expecting you to bring to him as a part of that sacrifice. And then finally in verse 19 he says, and by the way, and I didn't say by the way, but don't boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And that can be puzzling. Why? I mean, we could probably think of some things about how that just seems to carry some connotations of unfairness. Here's this mother providing the milk to cook their own offspring in. And maybe there is some of that, I don't know. But there is some archaeological evidence that the Canaanites sacrificed in their worship a lot of goats. And in the sacrifice, a part of what they did was to cook the meat in the milk of the mother of the sacrifice. And then that would be part of their feast, would be to consume some of that. But that archaeological evidence is by no means conclusive, but there is some out there to indicate that might be what was going on. So the exact whys behind that, you could make it this simple. We parents had to make it simple for our kids sometimes. Why can't I do that? Because I said so. That's not all wrong. When God gives commands and you ask the why question, really honestly, the most important part of the answer is, well, because God said so. And so God commanded this. We may not be able in this day and time, and maybe they couldn't either, I don't know, fully develop a reason why God would have this as a command, but he had it as a command, and so that's been a part of their heritage ever since. Clearly, God was establishing his nation to be a nation with a worshiping culture. It was to be focused on him, Yahweh, exclusively. It was to be focused on his position as Lord. Lord, we sometimes think of as a title, and it is, and we shouldn't diminish that, but it also is a functional description of who he is. He's master of everything. Again, once again, exclusively. He was leading them to be his light on a hill. He said they would be a nation of priests. They were to have a witness. They were to be an example. And in their example was to come justice. And it wasn't a justice in the eyes of mankind. It was a justice in the eyes of God, which as they practiced God's justice, it would become their justice. They would become sensitive to how people were treated. That was his intention, I'm sure. And it was to be a culture of kindness, gentleness, even toward enemies and strangers when possible. And so here's God establishing these kinds of things. Questions, comments, thoughts? Okay. Let's go ahead and read 20 through 33. It's a longer passage that way. But here's God now continuing. Let's remind ourselves as we read this. This isn't God speaking directly to the people. God's got Moses aside right now. And he's saying, Moses, I want you to go tell the people these things. And we're still in that download to Moses of what he's to go tell the people. And here's where he starts in with verse 20. Behold, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I prepared. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him. But if you truly obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. You shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds. But you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces. But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will remove sickness from your midst. There shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. I will send hornets ahead of you so that they will drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you a little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness to the river Euphrates. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you will drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, because they will make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So in this passage, God is concluding his directions of what to give through Moses, what he's to give to the people. And now he turns to orders regarding the conquest of the promised land. And he starts out with that word, behold. This means pay attention. This is significant. Don't miss this. I'm going to send an angel before you. And the purpose of that angel is to do more than one thing, but one is to guard you. And the other one is to lead you to the place that I have prepared. And I think we've got to realize that there's more to this right here than just a travel guide and someone to protect them. Yes, that's all there, but notice that not only is this angel going to do that, but God himself has prepared a place for them. In other words, they're not just going off somewhere to see how well they can do with things. God is taking them to the place, his jumping off point, first of all, and then to the land itself, for that God has prepared the situation so it's going to work for them. And he goes on in verse 21, be on your guard, be careful, obey his commands. In other words, don't rebel under him. Be certain you do this. Why? Well, if you rebel, he will not pardon your transgressions, because my name is in him. Who's this angel?
Who can forgive transgressions but God alone?
And who did God give that authority to on earth later on in history? This is the pre-incarnate Christ. This is the one that is given all dominion over this earth. All things are placed under his control. Jesus himself said that. Well, it didn't just start a couple thousand years ago in Israel, in Jerusalem. Jesus is here as the messenger of God, as the one that is acting out what God wants done on his behalf as God himself in the form of a pre-incarnate Christ. And so Jesus is going to be their guardianship. He's going to take care of them. He's going to take you to the place I've prepared. But that's why God says, be careful. This isn't just some sort of do the best you can situation. It never works that way with God. It doesn't work that way with God in our day today. We need to be careful. We may struggle with sin, but we need to be doing everything we can to mortify sin in our mortal bodies. We need to be God followers fully, wholly, and completely. And that's the call here as well. And the stakes are high. And the judgment that can come out of that is a strong judgment. If you rebel, the forgiveness that Christ could bring to leading you is not available to them. If you do, he will not pardon your transgressions. Why? Because my name is in him. What does that have to do with it? Why does that limit Christ as this angel in how he deals with their sin? Who is God? What is he? Be holy as God is holy. Can God look upon sin? And so in this time, in this place, responding to God out of a heart of obedience is necessary. And God has seen many other kinds of things from him. So here is Jesus coming aligned with Yahweh. He's the pre-incarnate Christ. And verse 22 says, if you truly obey him and do all I say, through him in other words, does what he asks you to, I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. What kind of an impact would that have on these people and their trekking toward and through the promised land as they get there? If out of obedience, God says, if they're your enemy, then they're my enemy. If they're your adversary, then they're my adversary. If we talk about that in positive terms, what would that do for them as they move through this time?
Confidence.
Certainty of outcome, safety. I mean, this is a big deal. And they should get this. I think if we were to keep on studying through their time in history, they don't. And I think their behavior shows they don't get it in many cases. There are a few. Joshua and Caleb come out pretty well. But the people as a whole operate out of their own eyes, and instead of obeying God and having confidence when they get to the promised land, they decide that land is too strong, too big, too hard, can't do it. Did they believe God was really making these people his enemies? They didn't get it, did they? But God says in verse 23, my angel will go before you. He's going to lead the journey. He's going to lead into the battle. And you are going to overcome the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, and the Canaanites. Let's look at that just a little bit. Go to Deuteronomy 3, 8 through 11. And I'm trying to just pick a few verses out, so it's a little bit hard on the context. But let's go to Deuteronomy 3, 8 through 11. This gives us a little bit of an idea who these folks were, if I can ever get there. Okay, 8 through 11. Now, when are we talking in this? The context of this is they've already been up next to the promised land. God has said, I've had it with you guys. You're going to wander around for 40 years. And this is a part of their wandering, but they still had military conflicts. And this gives us a little bit of insight into who these Amorites are. Thus, we took the land, this is verse 8 of chapter 3. Thus we took the land at that time from the hand of the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, from the valley of Arnon to Mount Hermon. Sidians call Hermon Syrian, and the Amorites call it Seir. All the cities of the plateau, and all Gilead and all Bashan, as far as Selek and Edrei, I don't know if I said those right, cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. Why did they call them cities of Og? Because, in verse 11, for only Og, king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. Behold, his bedstead was an iron bedstead. It is in Rabbah of the sons of Ammon. Its length was 9 cubits. And its width 4 cubits by ordinary cubit. These people were known as great warriors. And King Og might give us a bit of a hint as why. This bed, if we convert to cubits, was 13 and a half feet long. He was not short. He might have been thin as a rail, I don't know, but he was not short. Unless he liked to sleep sideways on it. But no, I don't want to make fun of it. This, why did they put this bed size in here? He was a big warrior type guy. And he was left as the king. And so these were people that lived in the northwest and earlier, northwest of Israel. By the time we get here, they're pretty much abiding in the southern hills of Israel, so they're down in the hill country down on the south side of Israel, which some of these other folks will be as well. The Hittites. The Hittites are descendants of Heth. Now, many of you were in the Genesis class. This is a pop quiz, probably not a fair one. But who was Heth? Anybody remember who Heth was? Yeah, I didn't either until I got back and went, who was Heth? Heth was the son of Canaan, the great-grandson of Noah, and his offspring, the people group that came out of his as him as descendants, were the Hittites. And they were primarily in the northern area up Turkey, Syria, but they stretched as far as Babylon at times. But there's a group of them, obviously, live in Canaan. And they have for a while. Go back to Genesis 23. We're going to look at verses 1 through 11. Genesis 23, verses 1 through 11. Genesis 23, 1 through 11. This is a little bit longer, and it's going to seem pretty familiar to you when I read it, but we'll read through it pretty quickly. Now Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. Sarah died in Canaan, and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and weep for her. Then Abraham rose up from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, there's your Hittites, sons of Heth. I'm a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. The sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, hear us, my lord. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. So Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land of the sons of Heth, and he spoke with them, saying, if it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and approach Ephron, the son of Zophar, for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns and which is at the end of his field, for the full price. Let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site. Now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even all who went in at the gate of the city, saying, no, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it, in the presence of the sons of my people. I give it to you, bury your dead. And it will continue, but we won't, to the point that Abraham gets it bought for what is deemed to be a fair price. All of this reckoning is with the sons of Heth. They're the ones that have settled up around the area of Mamre, as I recall. And Moses... Abraham wants to bury his dead there, and so he buys it from what would later be called a Hittite, sons of Heth. And so they were down in through the land of Israel in various places, in various ways, and a number of them were spread throughout the land of Israel, and they as a group were going to be ones that were overcome as well. The Perizzites, I didn't get as much good information, but they did live in Canaan. Their name implies they lived in the open country rather than in the cities. By the time we get to Joshua, they are covering a pretty broad area that is wooded hill country, much of the area west of the Jordan. So if you took the west of the Jordan, that tended to be where you would find the Perizzites, from probably somewhere around Jerusalem and out toward the Mediterranean and on south. And the Canaanites, today, if we wanted to look at the area the Canaanites covered, we'd basically be looking at Lebanon and Israel together. And they were very wicked, very idolatrous. I won't run you through the pop quiz again, but they descended from Noah's grandson, Canaan, who was the son of Ham, who is the one that was so offensive to Noah, and he cursed Canaan, and it was because of Canaan and Ham's sin against Noah. And it's interesting, by the time we get downstream from our chapter today and look at what goes on with Joshua and Caleb and the spies, when all the spies get sent in, and they go into this land of Canaan, so it's primarily the Canaanites, they saw a land of great plenty, huge crops, wonderful. Was that what God had described? Sure. But they also saw a strong, large people, and they were afraid of them. So afraid, they said, there is no way. They'll just crush us. They'll just step on us, and it'll be over. And so that's the people that God says they're going to be coming over the top of. And in verse 23, he makes it very clear, I, God, will completely destroy them. In verse 24, he goes on to say, you shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor live according to their deeds. You're not going to worship them. You're not going to give them homage, and you're not going to live in the way they would ask you to live. But instead, you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars into pieces. Well, the pillars were what they would put up. I mean, you see pillars around buildings today, don't you? They'll put pillars up front. These pillars marked out the worship centers, often buildings, and their greatness showed the greatness of their God. And God says, no, you're going to go in and break those pillars up. They were architectural pieces, if you will, to show they were sacred signs. Why was it important to destroy them? There's some easy answers, but there's one I want to make sure we think about a minute. What's an easy answer? Why do you want to destroy the pillars?
Well, they're a reference to the gods that are there.
Yeah.
That you want to get rid of, you want to remove every aspect of it, so you're not tempted to go after them.
Yes. Let's get rid of anything that would remind us of them, make us think of them as something, someone, even though they don't even really exist, but these so-called gods that could be worshipped. I really believe there's another piece to this.
Specifically, as you're referencing the high places, so these pillars and stone tablets would have been the places where these false gods would have had their sacrifices, like, conducted.
Yeah, it's the worship centers, and so they're doing that, yes. Yeah, you're right on, and they're putting those out, but honestly, when I thought about this, I thought about a fictional show I've seen a time or two where they have a totem pole involved, and in the show they give credit to this totem pole for doing good things and making the people also beyond any kind of vulnerability. These sacred places have no power. You don't have to be afraid to go in and destroy them. Destroy their pillars. They might be called high places, they might be called sacred, they might be something that you're supposed to be in awe of when you go in there. Do you have some fear, Israelites, as you look at these, that I don't want to offend their gods? No, go offend their gods. Get it over with. Learn these gods are powerless as you destroy their worship centers. And then he goes on in verse 25 and says, you shall serve Jehovah, the Lord your God. Well, Jehovah, or Yahweh, is the name of God, the great I am, right?
Right.
Now, what about Lord, the Lord your God? That is, that God here is Elohim, is the word that is used in the Hebrew, which means almighty. I mean, it gets used as a name for God, yes, it gets used in a lot of ways, but basically he's saying, you're going to serve the great I am, the almighty, completely almighty God. And so in bringing these names in, he's making it clear that they're going to worship him out of a knowledge of his greatness, as well as his being and his person and his power. And he says, as a result, I'm going to bless your bread and water. I will remove sickness from your presence. I'm going to provide life. Bread and water are foundational for people to have life, particularly at this time when bread and water was a lot of their subsistence. Oh, sickness? You're not going to have sickness. More than that, no miscarrying, There won't be anyone barren. I will fill up your days. That word fulfill your days. That word fulfill, when you go look at some of the other ways it could be translated, has been translated, they could have said, I will fill up your days. I will consecrate your days. I will replenish your days. I will overflow your days. I will give you satisfaction in your days. I don't know which ones of those words God would have wanted to emphasize, but here's God saying, if you serve me and me only, what I will do for you is almost beyond description. Sickness hasn't been gone from any society. Miscarrying happens. Barrenness happens. But if you follow me, it won't be in your land. And still, as he's working through dealing with these children, the promise in verse 7, 27, he says, I'm going to send terror ahead of you. I'm going to bring confusion to your enemies, to the people. I will make them turn your backs to you. That's a euphemism for run from you. So he's going to give them the military might and power to roll over the adversaries. I will send hornets before you to drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites. And you can find a number of ways people have talked about, what is this hornets? Was it literally he was going to send hornets? Well, actually, I think that might work. I've been around some insect situations where there was nothing as bad as hornets. The worst one was mosquitoes one time. That we got into a mosquito population this last spring in Canada so thick that after a while, the fact that the fish were really biting didn't matter. We wanted out. We're going to fish somewhere else. We'll catch less fish, whatever. It turned out we've caught really good, had good fishing elsewhere. But this stuff can drive you crazy. And so it may have been actual hornets. I think, honestly, that's my opinion. The hornet was sometimes a symbol for the Egyptian armies. And the Egyptian armies did have a tendency to go up through there and drive out people, but we see no record of that in what happens in the conquest of Canaan and Joshua and so on. And we also know that if you put the Egyptian army at the bottom of the sea just a short time before this, well, there is an Egyptian army to go run people out. So I don't buy into that, but some of the commentaries will work pretty hard to sell that to you. In verse 29, he says, now, by the way, we're not going to do this in a single year. And there's a reason for that. If we do it quickly, too quickly, the land will become desolate and it'll be overrun with beasts. In other words, we've got to do it at a pace you can occupy it, take it over, become fruitful in that area, and continue to move your way through this land. Otherwise, the wild animals will get it. I'll drive them out, verse 30, little by little, you can become fruitful and overtake it. Verse 31, your boundary is fixed by God, and this is what he says it is. It's from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, from the wilderness to the river of Euphrates. I will deliver the inhabitants into your hand, and you will drive them out. Okay. I wish this was easier. One way it could have been easier is if somebody had printed, had already had a map I could go steal that worked better. But they didn't. So here's what I stole to show you. Look at this one that looks like this first, not the one that has all the tribes on it. Also, I was very frustrated with the commentaries. They didn't try to explain this. What they did was said, well, this is where Israel wound up, so that must be it. Instead of, well, how did God define this? Well, first of all, and we'd already talked about this a little bit when we talked about their trek and the role of the Gulf of Aqaba and so on. But when he says from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, well, the Sea of the Philistines is the Mediterranean. And obviously the Philistines are down here in the southern part of the Mediterranean. And so you go over to the Gulf of Aqaba, which we're not really showing Egypt and so on there. That's on the east side of the Sinai. You see Sinai down there. There's a line that comes from that tip and comes up. And most folks that want to be literal about this would agree that's one border. That one's the easy one that goes from the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, this lower red line. That's probably what it is. Now, why they didn't draw a straight line on here, I don't know. But they didn't. And then we go from the wilderness to the river Euphrates. Well, the river Euphrates, you can see it up there in the top, it makes this meandering travel down eventually through Iraq and so on. And so is it that whole area, or is it more like they've drawn it here? I can't tell you that I know. But the wilderness down here is generally this area in southern Israel. That's generally the wilderness that's the most popular one you hear about. And so it's going to go up northward to the river Euphrates. Now, where's the eastern border? Well, that becomes an interesting question, because it certainly goes beyond the River Jordan. Okay, and so I'm not sure what that eastern border really is. If we followed the river Euphrates, which isn't on either map, but it would cover a lot of territory east of where we think of Israel being. And you'd get Lebanon and Jordan and a whole bunch of land area over there. Now, here's where the tribes, if you turn the page over, were mostly settled. And you can see that there was a pretty good-sized area east of the Jordan and east of the Dead Sea down there. And you can see it pretty much went down into that area we would call the wilderness. And it went up pretty close. It's still a ways away from the northern edge of that river Euphrates. One of the, they say, and I guess I have to believe them, I'm going to say it out loud, I don't know if it's 100% correct or not, but one of the ways they would talk about their nation in its wholeness before it was split and so on, they would say, from Dan to Beersheba. And you can see where Beersheba is down here in the middle of this Simeon. Now, that didn't mean Dan was the upper border and Beersheba was the southern border. It just means the area around Dan. Now, we're talking about city of Dan, not the tribe of Dan. The tribe of Dan is down there just east of Ephraim down there. You see it down in the middle. Now, we're talking about the city Dan that's way up here north, from the city Dan to the city of Beersheba down south. So I think we have a pretty good idea of the western, to some extent the northern, and the southern borders. That eastern border is the one that I wish I could say something more definitive about. And maybe somebody here has some information they could say, oh, the eastern border was this and this is why, but I couldn't get there with what was in this text or other places I looked. Questions, comments? So this just gives you an idea that where they settled would probably, and this is their initial settlement, this is how they drew lots for the land and where Joshua assigned them places as the result of the way that all worked out. And I do believe that the promise that we see here is beyond that to some extent in terms of where their borders would be. But that gives us a general idea of what that meant. Okay, well, we're just about done. So I'm going to take just another minute or so, because God tells them how to deal with the people in that area. In verse 31, he said he would drive them out, but he gives them an order. In verse 32, make no covenant with them or their gods. Verse 33, they will not live in your land. By the way, do you see the name change here? God keeps saying, the place I'm going to send you, and now he says, your land. Why? They will make you sin against me, for if you serve their God, certainly it will be a snare for you. And so that's in verse 33. That's the end of this. This passage where he tells him how to interact with the people in the land, what does it tell us that God knew about these Israelites? Did they have a tendency to follow other gods?
Yeah.
Yeah. They like some of the gods in Egypt even. At times we can see that from some of what we studied earlier. Would they make covenants with these other people?
Yeah.
Yeah. Time and again he has to say, don't worship those gods. They will. So God is giving them good warnings because he knows where they're inclined to head. And it's not going to be his fault when they do it, because he's providing for them in a magnificent way. Think of the magnificent ways that God has provided for us. Don't throw it away. Hang on to it. Follow it. Use it. Make the most of it. Questions, comments? Okay, thank you for letting me keep you another 4 minutes so that we could start next time with the next chapter. Have a great day.